They cracked eggs. She comes, he comes, and egg whites. That slick stick down to icky, down her thigh sides at the wrong time. These egg whites so tainted. These egg whites so bad timing. These egg whites that change lives. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. You can find us online at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. It's National Poetry Month, bitches. Oh, yeah, but seriously, it's National Poetry Month. And so on this 8th day of April, we're continuing on in the Emerald City to meet an independent publishing rock star and to find out why a raven is like a writing desk.
Curiouser and curiouser. Hello. The anti-Mason William Morgan here, and tonight we're spending 42 minutes with Amber Nelson, a poet and editor living in Seattle. She is the co-founder and poetry editor of Alice Blue Review and the entrepreneur behind Alice Blue Books and Shotgun Wedding. You can check out their online journal for free at alicebluereview.org. Her first full-length book is Anima Urgency and was published last year by Coconut Books. We are pleased to be meeting with her this evening. Hello, and how are you?
I am doing just marvelously, thank you.
Wonderful. So, just right off the bat, we alluded to Alice in Wonderland, but where does the name Alice Blue come from and why?
So, Alice Blue is actually a particular shade of blue that Teddy Roosevelt, I believe it. I see, and everybody keeps asking me this, but one of the Roosevelts, I think it was Teddy, had a daughter named Alice, and her favorite shade of blue was a particular shade of blue, and thus it was known as Alice Blue. How he came about the name was sort of a convoluted process of the three editors and founders of the journal, plus our friend who did photos for us for a while, getting together with like 10 names each, and we all could pick like a top five from the 10 names each that we had on the list, and the only one that we all had in our top five or whatever it was Alice Blue.
Particularly, what do you like about it? I mean, what was it?
Well, it's sonically interesting. It sounds good. It looks good. It has the Alpha Beta thing going on for it, which is actually ended up being our logo, though we didn't know that when we started out.
Oh, I get it. That makes a lot of sense.
And I like the name color combo. Like, it was really appealing. It feels good.
It's enigmatic, too, because it seems like it's a bit of a mystery.
We do get asked about it a lot.
Okay, and it has nothing to do with Alice in Wonderland.
Nothing whatsoever. Not that I don't love the story. I do.
Okay. Well, so our listeners probably don't know, or many don't, because we are living in a digital world, but what is a chapbook?
A chapbook is a small, usually handmade book, usually under 32 pages. In the universe of writing, I think it's traditionally considered like a stepping stone to a full-length book because they're smaller, usually done in more limited runs. And, you know, like with a much finer eye for what's handmade or done by hand. I personally tend to prefer the chapbook length. Good for one sitting, good for single projects, just like this whole complete thing. Plus, I'm interested in the design aspect of it, but yeah, usually handmade, small collections of poems by a single author.
And then how do you store chapbooks?
Store? Like in my own?
The thing about a book is it has a spine, and under 32 pages, this is almost like a pamphlet size.
Yeah, more like a, well, they're sort of related tangentially to zines. So I have mine in a...
Like a chapbook drawer?
I actually have a system of drawers that were originally designed for storing DVDs, which seems fairly obsolete these days. And it's about the right size. I have some odd-sized ones, so like a couple of the drawers are like the books are laid in flat inside them instead of like a DVD. I took out all of the little DVD dividers that was supposed to keep them up straight, you know, only five per divider. And I just have them in DVD drawers. I don't know how other people store them, though.
Would you compare them more to, like a 45, or is this more like an LP?
It's probably, well...
Somewhere
in
between.
You're going to have to speak in different terms for me because I don't do music. But I think the LP is bigger. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's more like a 45. I'm literally blushing because I didn't know that.
Well, then tell us, how many chapbooks do you have available as a poet?
Ones I've written, I think I'm at five, maybe four. Four, I think. I have one that was a split chapbook with A. Minetta Gould through Publishing Genius, and they did it sort of like, these are called split LPs, right?
Yeah.
Where you have one, okay, yeah,
one,
so it's
one
like
band
that.
On one side, and the, yeah.
So we have a book where I'm on one side and she's on another. I have a long poem chapbook out from Dancing Girl Press. An electronic chapbook through Hangman, and then the one you read from, Dutch Baby Combo, that just came out last year from Dancing Girl. So four.
Now, is this a new concept, or is this is actually like in something that happened back in the 1800s and 17?
I think it's probably been around that long, but not known as a chapbook. I think probably
what was done originally was
pamphlets.
Yeah, I just looked it up on Wicca because I was curious if this was like a product of like the internet age. Do you know what I mean? And
Right. Giving
these shorter, like single serving type of literatures. But it says here that a chapbook is an early type of popular literature printed in early modern Europe. The tradition of the chapbook arises in the 16th century as soon as printed books became affordable. So, I mean, I guess the necessity of having self-publishing would have been, you know, you would have to do it back then. But what is the inspiration for you guys doing it like this?
Well, for me, it was sort of...
What's the difference between I'm wondering, like, so I know that with Alice Blue Review, you have a specific intent, but then the chapbooks themselves with Alice Blue Books, that's a different intent, too.
Yeah, like, they're tied in. I solicit all the people I publish for Alice Blue Books are people we published in the online journal. People who I read their work and I was like, fuck, they're fantastic. I didn't even ask if I was allowed to swear. So then I asked them if they have a chapbook that, and if they'd be interested in my publishing it. So they're tied in, but it was a different impulse. We started Alice Blue Review from an impulse out of, like, not entirely being satisfied with what was being published, around knowing people who were really fantastic who weren't getting published, and really just sort of wanting to engage in the poetry community in a way that post-undergrad we weren't doing. And we had always intended to move to print, nebulously. We didn't have a firm concept of what that would mean, whether we'd be publishing books or print journals or whatever. But as time went on, it kept not happening. And I was in grad school and just decided, screw it, I'm going to do it. And since I was in love with chapbooks, that's what I decided to do. I had discovered tons of chapbook artists in various ways. I think the first ones I ever subscribed to were Cannibal Books out of Arkansas and Effing Press. And I don't even remember where they were located, to be honest. Just really rough, handmade books. And then later discovered more artist-focused chapbooks. Specifically, I'm thinking of Pilot Books, which was also a bookstore in Seattle, but unrelated. There was a press called Pilot Books that made just beautiful, beautiful artist-focused books. So I started doing that.
And are they primarily poetry?
The Alice Blue Books is entirely poetry. It's really my oeuvre, the one I feel most comfortable in and the one I spend the most time as a reader in. When I started Shotgun Wedding, which is sort of the opposite of Alice Blue Books. It's quick and dirty photocopy books in the true spirit of like zine culture. It's all Pacific Northwest writers, and it's all genres. So I even last year published a comic, or comic.
It's fiction, it's nonfiction, it's comics.
Yeah, the Shuckin Wedding is all genres, 6 chapbooks a year, published all at once in October.
Cool, yeah, and then you got some, I read, I mean, there's a number of questions, because it seems like this is a whole brand new world to me, and a lot of, I'm a fan of literature, but there's just all this inside, so like, this is indie literature, as far as I can tell, and so there's the SPP, and the APRIL, and the AWP, and you have Shuckin Wedding, and then critics go to these things and say, the best thing I found was these Shuckin Wedding chap books.
Yeah. Are you talking about the article in The Stranger?
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, that's exactly what
I was talking about. Yeah, that was really nice, actually. That was super flattering.
So what is an AWP?
It's the largest writing conference in the country, and I can never remember what it stands for. Association of Writers and Writing Programs, I think, something like that.
And that happened in Seattle this year? Does it move around?
It moves around. Last year, I think it was Boston. Next year, it's going to be Minneapolis.
Did you, as Alice Blue, have something on, like, in the thing, or was it, like, associated, like, there's just, it's like South by South. Everything's music for me. I'm really sorry.
It's quite all right. I know what South by Southwest is.
Okay. Yeah, but so, like, because it's got so much gravity, there's all kinds of ancillary cool stuff happening that you don't have to pay for.
Right. So, at AWP, you pay a buttload of money to get in. And then there's panels, which I wasn't involved in, and on-site readings that I wasn't involved in. And all that happens in the conference center. And then a giant book fair where it's like the biggest bookstore in the country. Like big presses, small presses are all there. They're all selling their books for crazy deals. You usually get to meet the publishers themselves, except for with the like major, major presses. For the most part, you get to meet the editors and publishers themselves, the people who actually work on the books, which is what I was doing for the bulk of the festival or the conferences. Sitting in the book fair and talking to friends and strangers alike as they walk by. Some of them bought books, some of them didn't, some of them took my information, sometimes they took their information. It's a big schmooze fest. And then at the end, when the book fair conference part of it ends at like 5:30 or 6, everybody then continues on to where the party is, which is any number of off-site readings. You go to usually... like I participated in two. I hosted a reading with Blues Books and Coconut Books where, you know, we had 12 readers and everybody piled into a big bar and drank and watched people read poems or like I read at a similar reading. And so these happen, multiples of them a night in various kinds of venues, bakeries and bookstores and coffee shops and bars and wherever they can find art galleries. Went to a place at a wildlife refuge this year.
And did you read anywhere?
I did. I read for Coconut at a bar with, they were reading with The Destroyer and Flying Guillotine. Somebody else, but I don't remember, and I feel like a jerk.
And how, so one of the interesting thoughts to, okay, like, I always have a million questions about things that I don't know.
You can only have one.
Okay, the one question right now is, when you're writing poems, do you read them out loud as you're composing?
I do, actually.
And is that normal?
You shouldn't ask me about normal. I have no idea. So... I think I read aloud in the composing process more than most people. It's also a huge part of my revising process.
Interesting. And then also, do you find that you like to read other poets' poems, like, in your voice better than when you hear them read them, or do you like the way poets read their own work?
Well, I think that really depends on the poet, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah. So there's
Man,
this...
Amber is owning you tonight, Douglas.
Sorry. There's there's this phenomenon called poet voice, and I think poets universally think it's shitty, and yet so many poets universally participate in its continuation. and so that's no good. You don't want that. But, I mean, I don't really go for slam either, so.
Uh-huh.
I like, or, it's not the genre I prefer. Oh,
you mean slam poetry, the
right,
interactive
poetry.
Between the, that's the type of poetry where they hold up the crowd participation, where they hold up the scorecards and whatnot.
Yeah, well, in competitions and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes the best poetry readings are the readings by poets who write the kind of poetry biased, obviously, the kind of poetry I'm interested in, more experimental, more linguistically playful, more, I don't know.
Do you like Burroughs? Do you like William S. Burroughs?
You
that
know,
participation, the interactive, like, moving of the words and the, you know what I mean? That to me was experimental. That's what I'm asking. And so I'm just trying to
hit
it.
He's not my favorite, but he's good.
It's interesting that Will brings that up, because that was something that I wanted to bring up too, because, but that's in referencing your book, your full-length book, In Anima
yeah,
Urgency.
Yeah, that's where I was about to go too, In Anima Urgency. I mean, we're a bunch of Jungians over here. I mean, we're pretty, and that title is very intriguing. Where were you going with that, Douglas?
Well, no, the William S. Burroughs, the final poem in the book, which is completely different than the structure of all the other poems, did you actually cut up all the poems and put them in a bag and then pull out pieces and recursive them?
Recursive, yes. Something you fall through that's done over and over.
Mm-hmm.
I did, in fact. I literally physically cut up every poem line by line, not word by word, but line by line, and brought my kitchen table into my living room and just rearranged and rearranged and rearranged and rearranged until I had what I really wanted.
That's Burrow-esque to me.
Right.
That,
yeah.
I'm not saying,
I mean, I think
you probably did it better than Burroughs. We're not arguing that point, but that is like something that was definitely popularized by him.
What's interesting that I've found in looking at your work is how you definitely have a distinct voice, but then the difference between Dutch Baby Combo and In Anima Urgency is like night and day.
Yeah, I think that's true of most of the projects I've done. So say you're in a writing workshop, and I was in a writing workshop, and my biggest complaint as a participant in the writing workshops was that people didn't seem to want to approach the other person's work on the other person's work's terms. So like, there's a dozen writers in a room, and we all have different styles and preferences and interests and topics of whatever. And rather than saying, you know, this person's goals, this is what this person is going for, this is what this person is trying to achieve, and I'm going to try to respond to it that way, people are like, well, I think that's pretty lame because it doesn't fit into my particular aesthetic. and don't get me wrong, I've definitely participated in some of that myself, but I think as a writer, my response is always like, so there's this thing that's on my mind, and I find the right avenue to talk about it, or I would hope that that's what happens. My goal is that form follows content, that the energy of the piece will satisfy whatever intention is behind it, and not just, you know, I write narrative nature poems, and so all of my narrative nature poems, look at my narrative nature poems that all sound and look the same.
In Anima Urgency is kind of like a process book, where you have a process to compose the poems?
This book was definitely, yes.
And then is it cheating to, like, talk about that? And then there's also this other wing of, like, poetry slash literature called the Ulipos or Ulipos?
Ulipo, yeah.
Could you explain what that is and if you fall into that category, if this book does?
So Ulipo was actually a specific group of people, French, I believe, who sort of, and they're not specific. It happened at other times, and there's other groups that participated in similar things, but they believed in process-based writing, basically. And so contemporary writers, especially in the universe that I participate in, use Ulipian structures to sort of get into the writing. And the idea is that, A, you can't not make sense, although I don't entirely agree with that, and B, that, well, at least I think that by writing through this process, you're able to get at something else that you didn't necessarily know you were trying to get at, because your subconscious is going to bring it out via the process either way.
That's a thread.
That's a what?
That's a thread. It's a concept that we deal with a lot on this show. When we talk to artists, we talk to musicians, and we always find out that there's a lot more meaning inside their work that they're not aware of upon the creation of the product. You know what I mean? There's always an unconscious level of influence that,
right,
that you're
so,
just hinting
right
at there. So,
as it, like with Anima, I'll talk about the process. It actually started during National Poetry Month. I was doing NaPoWriMo, and I invented a process to use just to write a thing, where I started with a single word and using sound sense and associative sense and etymology and rhyming and whatever I could get from that single word, whatever rabbit hole, Alice in Wonderland, I could fall down to get myself somewhere. And, you know, I wrote the first one, and I was like, oh, it was really different from anything I've ever written before, but it was kind of fun, so I'm going to write more. Plus, it was a really great way to satisfy my poem a day prerequisites. And that's literally how it started. I'm just trying to satisfy my poem a day prerequisites. But at the same time, I was reading a lot about time and thinking about my philosophies of time and trying to figure out what I actually believed about the universe.
Right, which is really interesting because you're speaking about the act of creation, time and language, and God in the same, like you're blowing up the universe to discover it, kind of.
Yeah, and also kind of shrinking it. It's sort of a micro, well, I mean, like one word exploded outward to deal with this bigger thing. I kind of felt like my mind was blown when I was done with it because I had no idea. I had no idea what I was getting at.
Uh-huh. And so then the word, each poem is a word, essentially.
Right.
And are they kind of hidden in there, or is it...
I mean, it depends on the poem. Sometimes the word is literally just that first pun, because like In Anima Urgency is a pun from In an Emergency, which is from the Frank O'Hara poem Meditations in an Emergency.
Uh-huh.
So then in the words, they operate in a similar way. Like there's a poem, and this is the one I always use for an example when I'm talking to people. There's a poem that starts say she ate, which is also satiate.
Uh-huh.
And that was the word I was working with in that poem, and you'll find, I think at the end I made a pun on ingest as in to eat, ingest as in to joke.
Right.
So sometimes it's really just that clear. It's the first pun or it's embedded in there somewhere, and sometimes it's not hidden. It's just a word that appears very quickly. But they're 5-line poems, so usually the word appears in some form pretty early on. But I'm not even sure I could define the rabbit hole I fell down on any of these poems, like how I got from A to B. I can talk about some of the relationships between things, but after I wrote them, the poems started to mean something other than what they were when I was writing them.
And then as a poet, I'm curious, how do you read poetry? Is it like shots when you have a poetry collection, or is it more like you're drinking a glass of wine and you'll read it over and over again? Or do you like read through the whole book and then read it again later and pick out the ones you like? Or
I can say I've honestly done all of those. The Duino Elegies by my bed, and that's something I dip into pretty regularly. And I also have an anthology that I've been slowly working my way through, like a poem at a time by my bed. I've read the entire collected James Schuyler, entire Frank O'Hara collected, and the entire Spicer collected a couple times each. But then there are lots of books that I just read through once. Some books I take my time reading through once. A lot of books I read a couple of times. Some books I've read and kept for if I ever teach a class again purposes, but I'll probably never read it on my own otherwise.
And then do you have a preference for, what I realized is that the Dutch Baby Combo poems were whimsical and delicious. You know, they were really fun. And they're self-evident, I guess. But then the poems in Inanima Urgency were a little, they had a little harder shell to crack. It seemed like I wanted to spend more time with those. Do you like to read both, all kinds of poems, or?
I do like to read all kinds of.
Like difficult, I guess.
Most kinds of poems. I'm fine with a difficult poem. I would say that Inanima, it's weird to have it as my first book because it's much more closely related to books I've read and resisted. Even if I admired what it was doing, it was something I resisted as a reader.
Hmm.
And that was weird to feel so close to something that I felt like other people would be blocked from, or like the gate would be, like it would just be a harder lock to pick, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I think poems should be puzzles, they're not. And so it depends. I guess it depends on the payoff. In the end, some poems are worth the work, and sometimes I don't think they are. And sometimes the poems I don't think are worth the work are totally worth it for other people, and vice versa. So there are plenty of difficult poets that I have loved, and I'm willing to take my time.
Who are your main influences?
Influences, I don't know. Sometimes I know. Like, Dutch Baby Combo is super, I think, super influenced by Lorraine Niedecker. And Inanima, the title was inspired from Frank O'Hara, but the poems themselves are not very New York school-like. It's probably more likely that it was influenced by two classes I took while I was at Boise State, where I read Louis Zukoski, his 80 Flowers, which I think is what this book is most closely related to. And then Susan Howe, who was also really difficult. But for me, lots of people love Susan Howe, but I found her really challenging. And love her sister, Fanny Howe. I think she's great.
Could you read us a poem? And it could be any poem that you're in the mood for.
Okie dokie. let me see.
Well, because we've been talking about it, now our listeners are warmed up. They're ready for some poetry.
Okay. Do you mind if I read a longer thing?
Sure, yes.
It's a newer piece. It's called Destruction Hunger. And it has a little quote from Clarice Lispector from The Breath of Life. When I feel hunger, I have a reason to live. My spirit has projected this murder upon you, born into an innate hunger. Before speech, we made our need understood, as in hunger came first. Outside, the sky is not quite blue, and exertion gets the blood going, so it might spray into the mouths of every insect, mosquitoes. Blood inspires certain kinds of hunger. Trees in the forest, felled and rotten. Life bleeds out in shoots of hunger. Everything must eat. Cedar or fir or the rotting corpses of bears. My intestine surprising likewise. All things around me are destroying and being destroyed. Agony in my throat, clouds of black nicotine, wet and clandestine vision from all the swallowed life. We throw parties for destruction everywhere. Exposed brick, splintering benches, everything coming undone. Look anywhere. Look anywhere and you can see it. Cracked paint, the shudder of withdrawal, the crackle of someone's tired breath in a microphone. When you crave truth like air, you will know the truth, if you wish. The apple of sweetness, the itch for pleasure, cruelty. To reach for pleasure is the struggle against death. The act of living does this. Wishes destroy. We stare at each other in a dim to know each other's desires, to know the truth of each other. And so we'll be destroyed in separation, bodies wounded in loneliness. My need is great. I am made of blood and shit and making blood and shit essential. A plague of the body destroyed by crows in the throat, searching and emptiness. Sometimes I light candles. I set them on the coffee table and just watch. The wax and wick disappearing into light. And into dark, I think of disappearing. Then the sun rises light and hunger returns anew, a wound reopened. Have you ever seen a person break, heard the crack in their voice when the weight of survival presses their organs? Disharmonic. Radioactive, how you can feel it from the sound, toxic, arise. Loneliness like hunger speaks a dangerous wound, embodied void. Our thoughts of hunger when destruction, when loss. Desire is a destruction, arousal, a gravity in reverse. I want these things. Fucking love, fucking companionship, fucking fucking. To be fucking embodied in another's body. To fill absence and be filled. In the name of fucking, the great gaping curve, the opening expands, pulses with that gravity. Hunger, craving, desire, need, absence, wound. 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 I have been loved before. It has always been destroyed. Always destroyed outward. Has destroyed other things. The hymen, it bled. And desire opened a wound, continually a canyon. Desire, a screaming free fall in the body. An arrow shot through the cunt to pierce the heart. So hearts are broken, destroyed. Desire always eats the heart eventually. Desire eating hearts, eating lovers, eating meals, eating each other, eating air, eating earth, eating future, eating indiscriminately. I once walked to the beach, the peninsula, held to the coast with only the shortest expanse of sand. The beach, broken by kelp, the rank flesh of it, the bugs forming above like vultures. Hunger is a violence on the beach. Not far, a ship washed ashore by a tsunami, ripped by barnacle and flesh. There are times when the tiger must rip out the throat of the taisu, tufts of horsehair stuck in their teeth like corn. Sometimes all of the predators, the wolves and bears and hyenas, lay dead in the middle of the roads, dozens, their organs all whole on the gravel. Sometimes the whale washes dead ashore, a meek playground. All of fiction and sometimes life moves towards apocalypse and horror. The brown modeling of a leaf before it breaks, the ripped foot of a tree exposed, its tender inner flesh. Apocalypse is personal only at the moment of our own death. We forget about the birds eating seeds and insects, destroying life alike. Lately, I have been dead for weeks. I've let all my blood go. I've let all my blood go with my hunger for nothing. At some point, I no longer hunger for anything, no forward, no pleasure, and I eat without thinking or just sleep, and consumed myself by the desire to want anything, a bloodless dying. I tear my own muscles in prayer to save myself, a prayer of blood, the skin ripped from feet in motion, and take the smallest steps to conserve an enchantment, the perfect morning light on old growth that practically breathes. Still, waterfalls tear down the mountains, wear down the stone from snowmelt. Blood blooms purple on my leg, and the bunch berries turn from white blossoms to sharpened red. I can smell the heat the trees give off, singed by suns. You are nowhere to be found, a wound now, an absence. Desire only means we are alive with an emptiness, and that emptiness, at the core, is aching for, until the gravity of sleep pulls us heavy into dark.
And so what do people do at the end of poetry readings?
They snap. You didn't know that?
They don't snap.
They do this thing. Coffee house snap. You didn't know that? Fucking for fucking sake. That's my shit now.
Well, it's interesting. I wanted to share that when I was preparing for this interview, I learned two things. And the first thing is that you're a very good poet. I had no idea. And you're really, really good. And
thank
then
you.
Also, I think you're freaky, too, which is wonderful. So tell us, are you the only famous author from Puyallup?
No, I'm not. So Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune, also Dune the movie.
Right, right.
Is from Puyallup.
Yeah, and so this is one of those things that comes up in a lot of the interviews that you've given, is that you do have this really interesting pop culture vein that is definitely a part of your life.
Oh, yeah, super much. Yeah. I totally love pop culture.
And so that, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is one of your bedrock things? Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I own the collector's 7 seasons, everything with special features, and I've watched it all the way through a few times. Don't tell anybody.
Oh, well, you just told everybody.
I know, right?
But, hey, yeah. We're nerds here, so we're cool with that.
But so the most interesting thing, though, that I found, though, is that, and it might have been when you were working on Inanimate Urgency, but maybe not, that you were playing with this idea of the simultaneity of all time.
Right, yes, totally. That's totally exactly what it was.
And that's what it was. So you're working on Inanimate Urgency, and you're realizing that our perception of past and present and future is our perception, and that actually...
So all 7 seasons of Buffy happen at the same time.
Simultaneously. How rad is that?
Right. No, I mean, this is definitely something that we play with.
Yeah.
Have you ever read Philip K. Dick?
I've read some. I can't say that he is my most read science fiction author.
Oh, yeah.
But I've read some short stories.
And that was the other thing, is that when you were working on that book, you were reading a lot of science fiction.
Yeah, well, the science fiction doesn't really... Sometimes it takes breaks. But really, I'm usually... I read a lot of sci-fi. It's my genre fiction of choice.
And so what are you reading right now? Is there anything fabulous that you want to share?
Well, I'm a little ashamed. I read Divergent with a friend of mine.
And what did you think?
I think it's as bad as Twilight. Why do people not realize this? Like, I read Twilight too, but whatever. Because, like, Harry Potter was well-written, and The Hunger Games was well-written, but Divergent is just badly written with dumb characters and, like, the subtlety of an anvil.
Well, you have to understand who the audience is as well, though. I mean, this is gothic. This is gothica. This is like the lowest of the low. It's not highbrow art by any means.
But that doesn't mean it has to be literally badly written. I mean, I found typos in the edition I read. It was a problem.
Dan Brown, do you read that?
I have not read the Dan Brown, no.
Read the Dan Brown. No, like, it's Dan like Brown. This entity of its own.
I have not read the Dan Brown. I probably won't read.
That probably is a wise choice. So do you have anything coming from you that we can expect in the nearest future? What are you working on?
Well, my second book was picked up, but it's being announced in May. And
will that be Coconut Books?
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah, Coconut. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. The date will be set in May. I'll know when it'll come out, but that's exciting. And then I'm sort of working on a second poem related to that hunger poem that I just read. Also about space time, because I'm real nerdy.
Which is fine.
Yeah. But
that was 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us, Amber.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Amber Nelson on SyncBook Radio, a production of thesyncbook.com. More information about the work of Amber can be found at aliceblurreview.org. For more information about the SyncBook, our guest, to check out past shows or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you like the podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. The more you give, the more we give. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and too warm, a lovelorn worm to mourn.
Oh, what an ordinary day. Take out the garbage, masturbate. I'm still holding for the laugh. The dogs will bark, so let them bark. The birds will cry. In the